This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for another episode of the Western Rookie Hunting Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson, and today we are joined by Mr. Jaden Bales. Jaden, how are we doing, man?
Yeah, I'm doing good. How are you this morning?
I'm doing good. Okay. Like, back in the day, when I say back in the day, I mean the last handful of years, all my contacts out west have just been like, dude, drought, dude, like it's so dry or it sucks out here. But I feel like, now I'm not saying this is everywhere, but my South Dakota contact has been like, dude, we've had some decent rain this year, you know, or, you know, some guys I know that hunt in North Dakota or guys that I know that hunt in Wyoming. They're like, dude, we've had some okay rain. Right. Not ideal, but still better than the life sucking drought that we've had for the last handful of years. What have you seen this past summer?
Yeah, it seems like a lot of things are pretty pocketed. So where I spend the most time in like Lander, Wyoming, man, we're kind of right on the edge of what would be like kind of, you could go either way right now for the last month of before hunting season. If we get a little bit of monsoon, we'll be looking good. But if it dries out real bad, we'll be in rough shape. But man, it just is always, I grew up in a farm and ranching family, and it was, my grandpa always would say, so, like, there's never a perfect year. There's never, like, if you get too much rain, then, you know, in the case of like this hunting example, it's like, well, then you end up with too much snow and a lot of animals die off. If you don't get any of it and you're like, we're in a drought, well, then animals are not getting enough feed and they're going to have antler growth issues, and then they're going to have recruitment issues on the other side of drought. So, man, it's just the way of like arid states in the West is like, it's never going to be perfect. So when you're in like some sort of mid ground, like we are right now, that's about as good as you can ask for in my mind. So it's just one of those things. Like, I just kind of take it for what it is, go hunt every year and just, you know, it's wild. You know, right after the hard winter, I found the biggest buck I've ever chased. And I was like, oh, well, shoot. Like, I thought they were all dead. And here's, and I ended up shooting another nice buck that was 7.5 years old. So whenever I see like sweeping generalizations of the West or how things are doing, I'm like, well, it's not going to really pertain to the individuals I'm looking for. Like, you only have a tag for one animal in most of the West. So I'm only looking for one, you know, whether it's a deer or an elk on any specific hunt. So I'm never too bothered by the changing seasons. It's just, and again, maybe that's just because I grew up with the, you know, farming grandpa who was just like, well, if we were going to get worried about every weather condition, then I'm in the wrong line of business. So,
right. That's a fact.
Yeah,
that's a fact. I can remember growing up and my grandpa, he would always say, yeah, we could always use a little bit more rain, but I'm not worried about it. Right. And it's just like, okay, well, is what it is, man. So, talk to me a little bit about your experience is though, and let's focus on, like, when I think the West, the three main animals that I think about hunting are antelope, mule deer, and elk. Okay. In your experience, what does drought do to those animals?
So I really learned a great lesson in drought back in 2021. I was archery hunting mule deer with a couple buddies. We found some bucks to chase, and I was like, I like this one. He's a bigger, I wouldn't say bigger, but he was bigger of the bunch. There was probably 8 bucks together, 3x4. And I was like, I think he's like the oldest of the bucks, but like he doesn't score worth a crap. And if anyone remembers, 2021 was like in the middle of the worst droughty years. And I was like, man, maybe he's 4 years old. I don't know, like 3 or 4. He's just like a 140-inch 3x4. And long story short, I actually got that buck and was able to send the teeth in to get him aged. And that 140-inch 3x4 was 6.5 years old. And I was like, and I look at the drought monitor and I'm like, okay, that makes sense. Like, so you get that part. Like, if you're in the middle of the drought, you're going to obviously see some detriments to like antler growth and animals are going to be in worse body condition. But then the big thing that I realized specifically from that drought system is like, you end up with really poor, fawn recruitment, and you end up with really poor, body condition in females. And so what you see there is like a big dip in reproduction. And I'm like, okay, so maybe this year, you know, we're not great on antler growth, but God, it hammers you on future years, like recruitment as well. So like the whole northern and eastern parts of and southeastern parts of Wyoming from that drought that was 2020 to 2022, they had major like dips and declines in just how many babies were hitting the ground. And in the meantime, like you had some mountain, the really famous mountain units in the state, like we're doing okay. Cause when you have that elevation change, like you can kind of compensate for some drought, but even then their winter range was in rough shape. So when you're looking at this droughty conditions, it is really long-term. It's like much more harmful long term than I think even like a winter kill is. And I've listened to some really cool I'm just nerding out about the biology of all this stuff. And there's some cool research that's been done both in Wyoming and in Utah talking about drought versus winter kill. And it's like the science says if you want like good robust populations, it's okay to have a winter kill that impacts you for a year, and then they have great rebounding. And we saw that in Wyoming the last 2 years. It's like record fawn reproduction, even though a bunch of animals had died from the winter. So I'm over here like, you know, rain is a good thing. Snow is a good thing in the longest term. And, you know, as I'm thinking about hunting, like I am planning on hunting every year. And so I'm just kind of like going to ride out the dips and valleys and just enjoy the time we have out there. So yeah to your point, it's just like, you know, you're going to have some rough years. You're going to have some good years. But then you never know when you find diamonds in the rough, like even on the rough years. So yeah, I'm all
which
about
is,
it.
Which is kind of crazy because usually what happens is you have a rough winter. Right. Yep. A rough winter, you're going to have some winter kill, but then all that snow leads to water, and then that water is good for the spring, which could have good antler growth. You know, it's like, you can't, it's almost like you can never have the perfect condition where you have a mild, you know, you have a mild winter, and then you want a wet spring where it's, you know, enough to get everything greenish. And then, you know, it's funny. Yeah. I went to South Dakota one year, and I was walking through knee-high prairie all the time. I was like, oh my God, this is awesome. They have plenty of stuff to eat. And I talk with the locals, and they're like, you know how rare this grass that you're seeing is? It's so rare. And then the next 2 years I went, it was like ankle high, and it was hot. And I was like, I get it now.
Yeah,
I get it. So
the other side of this equation that I think a lot of folks, it impacts their hunt more than it impacts the animals is, well, I guess in different cases, is when you have this big water event, and you get all this great forage growth, and then you get it all dried out, and then you have big wildfire issues. You know, yeah. Like last year in 2024, coming off the 22-23 winter, we had all this like forage on the ground at dried out in 2024, and then we ended up with some of the bigger fires that Wyoming has seen. The Pack Trail fire was almost 90,000 acres. The Elk fire, over 100,000 acres. And then you had the Remington draw fire, and then the House draw fire, or not the Remington draw fire, the Remington fire and the House draw fire, which were both giant ones in eastern Wyoming. And that's all just a you know, reaction to the good moisture that came the year before. So yep. you certainly have to, you know, this is the natural cycles of the world. And, you know, for the most part, we also we're looking at such a short time horizon compared to how everything actually works on the ground. We'll be like, man, like this winter impacts me this year. And then the next year you're like, God, well, the fire shut down my hunting area the next year. And it's like,
yeah,
brother, the, you know, earth doesn't give a crap about your hunting plans. It's going to just do right. What it does.
Right. And what's crazy about all this, and it's not anything new. It might be new to us, but it's not necessarily new to the animals. They yeah. have lived and have adapted to this life of, you know, surplus and drought and decline and harsh weathers. You know, like I think one of my favorite statistics about mule deer specifically is the amount of vegetation that they can eat to stay alive out west. I believe a whitetail, I think they said a whitetail can eat 250 different types of vegetation, while a mule deer can eat over 400 or close to 500 different types of vegetation. And so that tells me that they have adapted to be able to eat just about anything to stay alive.
Dude, it's so cool. You can chase them from the valley floor to the top of the mountain, like literally
yeah.
the top of the mountain. Yesterday morning I was glassing for deer, and I was at, I've got my map here. I'm cheating. I was at like 5,000 feet. And then 2 weeks ago I was up at 10,000 feet, both, and found bucks in both places, you know? And it's like yeah. one of them I'm over here, like, dodging rattlesnakes, and the other one I'm dodging mountain goats to chase yeah. mule deer. It's pretty cool, but yeah, to your point, there's that makes them pretty special.
Yeah. What other natural occurrences have that we maybe haven't discussed that impact? Let me ask you this before I ask that question. What does drought, and I'm specifically talking about drought or wet years, what species is affected the most by harsh conditions, do you think?
It sure seems like deer have the most fickle, specifically like reproduction. You also see it in pronghorn pretty aggressively, but then you have elk that are like, you couldn't kill an elk with a hard winter. Like they just yeah. find a way, that just because they have bigger body mass, they can get around in deep snow. They dig up, you know, different things to eat. But then the difference with the pronghorn versus mule deer is pronghorn just reproduce really quickly. So like in Wyoming, you saw really, really fast twinning rates following our hard winter. So even though there's quite a few pronghorn that died, they can reproduce and multiply pretty quick compared to your mule deer. So I think, yeah, your mule deer in particular probably are the most susceptible just because they take longer to bounce back than a pronghorn. And then elk are just like, man, I don't think that anything really bothers them too much. They just move around and cause mayhem. So they can figure it out.
Other than like from a natural standpoint, other than like drought and maybe harsh winters, is there anything else that you've noticed from a natural standpoint that really affects population or antler size or just overall abundance of animals?
You know, one of the we've mentioned, the stickiest one, I call it that because I don't like diving in too deep because it's powers beyond my control that really influence it. But the stickiest one is usually predators, right? Mm-hmm. And people will complain that there's too many predators and like right now. And I kind of look back in history. I was like, brother, we kind of extirpated for the most part our large predators, and we were doing quite a bit of poisoning back in the mid 19th century. And then you also had the hide hunting that was happening in the kind of elimination of the predators in the early 1900s. And then before that, there wasn't much for predator hunting before pre-European contact. So man, it's like that is its own can of worms. It's like when do you want to start your comparison? Are we comparing to pre-European contact? Are we comparing to the 1900s when things were extirpated, or the mid 1950s when we were poisoning stuff, or, where do we want to start our measuring stick? And, that's where I think a lot of those conversations kind of go off the rails, and, you have a lot of disagreement about what to do with predators. I love predator hunting, man. I try to get a bear every year. I'll shoot coyotes. Like, haven't shot a wolf yet, but I tried last year, just got away from me. And, so it's just one of those things that I think you'll find some research, like different places are more or less impacted by them than others. And I think more often than not, people blame them when they might not be the case, like whether it's Lander or Bozeman, Montana, like you've got freaking housing developments that are taking up all the winter range and you don't have a place for those animals to go to, that also, will exacerbate predator issues. For instance, like if they can't escape, and find new places to be safe, like that causes problems. If they don't have forage to be really healthy, like, so they can run away from stuff, that also, that causes problems. So it's all interconnected, man. And that's the hardest part about all of it is like, because things are tied together, we want to blame one thing, but it's usually, a whole conglomeration of things that are impacting mule deer size or whatever. Yeah.
By the way, some of my favorite YouTube videos to watch are security cameras from California when a mountain lion will jump a fence and rip a dog right off its chain and then just take it back to wherever. And then you just see the chain slowly come back over, the chain's going over until it disappears. Those are, you want to talk about like, and then like statistics, like what did they say that a mountain lion can potentially kill one deer a week for an entire year?
Yep.
And that statistic to me is mind blowing, that a predator is so good at what it does. It just kills, it can kill with that much efficiency.
Yeah.
And then when you hear the other stories of like this wolf pack or a bear or something, or coyotes were hassling a mountain lion. So now the mountain lion would go out, it would kill an animal, leave it, and then it would go out and kill another animal for itself. So it was killing two. Forever, because it had learned that, hey, these animals are stealing my kill. And in order to prevent that, I'm going to just kill and leave one for them. That blows my mind.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Spring break isn't what it used to be. It's better. This spring, stay 3 nights and get a $50 Best Western gift card. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Visit bestwestern.com for complete terms and conditions.
Yeah, they're such efficient killers. I've been on the hunt for a mountain lion myself. I consider this a once in a lifetime project if I'm going to spend time trying to get one without dogs. And I would certainly hunt with dogs. I just don't have the budget to go pay someone to go. But it doesn't mean I'm not going to go try. And it is incredible once you start learning about the specifics of how they operate. Man, it is. They might be the hardest animal to hunt without dogs. You were just talking about like dogs taking critters. And when I was a kid, we would feed hay out of this barn at our neighbor's house, and we had barn cats to try to keep the mice down. And then one day we were like, man, our barn cats aren't around anymore. Where'd they go? And then there was a covey of quail that would also live in the barn. And then all of a sudden the quail disappeared, and we're like, what in the heck? And then it snowed and we saw mountain lion tracks, and we're like, dude, there's a mountain lion living in a barn. And so sure enough, we like called up the neighbors, and we got a half dozen, maybe 8 people to surround the barn. And then vividly remember them being like, okay, so now what? Like, we got guys with guns on all sides of the barn, and they're like, who's going in? I was in middle school, and then my buddy is 2 years older than me. He was one of my hunting buddies in high school, Blake. And we were like, all right, Blake, you're going in. So Blake goes in with a pistol and climbs up on the hay bales, and sees the mountain lion like face to face with it, like shoots and hits it, but it doesn't drop right away, right? So it comes running out the other side, and then all the good old boys that were like our neighbors and stuff just unload on it, and got that mountain lion. And it's actually at Blake's house now, and it's he's got it mounted like grabbing a quail out of the air, which is pretty sweet. But
did you have to get a specific tag for that?
So that was in Eastern Oregon, and back in the day, or it still is the case, like it's a 365-day season.
Okay. Yeah. So they're considered a nuisance?
Yeah, and they can't really hunt. You can only hunt them without dogs, no bait, anything like that. So basically, and you can get 2 tags. If you fill your first one, you can get another tag in there. Dude, they're like $16 for non-residents to go have one of those in your pocket. So if you're in Oregon, you should definitely do that. But to your point, it's like, these states that restrict really good management of animals have to deal with the consequences. And, I kind of saw that growing up for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, man, last time I was in, Western Nebraska, hunting, we stop and we talk to locals all the time, and every single one of them, it made it sound like mountain lions were behind every tree, and they were responsible for everything that was wrong with that state. And I'm just like, Jesus, man, like we haven't seen one track. We were out for, a week, bombing through the landscape, and we didn't see any tracks. Of course we weren't necessarily looking for mountain lions. I will say this though. You want to know what's freaky is we're walking in the pit. We walk down to this big overlook for an afternoon hunt, and we're glassing mule deer coming out of these bottoms and then coming up to these hay fields or these alfalfa fields. And then, nothing came by us. So we had to go back, and it's dark, and you see eyes in your headlamp at like 100 yards reflecting. And then the first one we saw was like trotting like this. And I'm like, oh, that's a coyote, right? That's a coyote that they trot
just
like
trot
that.
Along. Yeah.
But then you see this other set of eyes just like dead stable. And when it went through the wood, then it started walking. It was like fluid. It was like its head was still. And I'm like, that is a cat of some kind. because it was fluid through its movement. And I was like, I got goosebumps on the back of my, I'm actually getting goosebumps now thinking about it, because we watched it in our headlamps circle us and get downwind of us. And then it disappeared. And so it was like, he wanted, it was so comfortable in what we were that it wanted to come and check us out and to see if maybe we were something that it should eat or not. But I think then it got freaked out and then it left. But that's a mountain lion encounters or bear encounters. Like, I've never had one, but I feel like that's something where I would get a little spooked not having that kind of stuff in Iowa.
Yeah, probably. It's funny, you know, even talking to people who don't spend a bunch of time who live out west, it's definitely possible to kind of hype it up in your brain. And at this point, you know, like last year, I had a pretty spicy run in with a grizzly bear, and I at some point, and there's like a fine line of like being too comfortable, and then being too afraid and not able to make the right decisions at that moment. Right. So hopefully, you know, I'm trying to live right there in the middle where I can stay calm. And I think that's for anybody hunting out west, you know, you got to live in that middle part where you're calm enough to make actions that are going to, you know, be right for the situation. But then also don't be like looking at a bear coming towards you, be like, oh, that's fine. You know, like you should probably do something. So yeah, I mean, it's getting to the point too, like that bear encounter I'm talking about right now is we were pheasant hunting down in the river bottoms. Like the dogs had pushed a bear towards us. And we were like, oh my God, no, like don't do that. So it is getting to the point where, you know, even when you're in the low country, depending on where you're at, you got to pay attention to that stuff and know what's around for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Let's transition here.
Okay.
And let's go to what you do. Okay. You're on this podcast for a reason, because you're very knowledgeable about hunting the West, hunting specific states, things like that. You do a lot of scouting. You own a company called Hunt West. What is Hunt West? What do you do? Explain that to us.
Yeah. So Hunt West basically is like a travel agency where I'm helping people figure out how to hunt different new places in the West. I think the best way to kind of explain how it got started was my own experience was I grew up in, like we mentioned, like I had this family farm that we hunted sometimes, and specifically for mule deer and whitetail. And then that was my mom's side of the family. My dad's side of the family, longtime hunters. My grandpa still hunts with a recurve. He's trying to hunt elk, and he goes back to the same unit that he grew up in and sits on these couple of, you know, travel features. And, you know, with as much respect as possible to my family, I love them dearly, but dude, we did not have that much success when we were out hunting. And my dad, he kind of picked up some things as I got older and started getting a little bit more effective. But specifically those older generations, just as time went on, they weren't having much success. And so when I went off to college, I would drive the 6 hours to go hunt, you know, the family place or neighbor's places, because I didn't know how to find new places to hunt. And once I started like diving into like, okay, dude, I don't want to drive 6 hours to go back to the ranch and hunt. Like, how do I find some public ground spots? I started realizing like, oh, there's a lot to this. Like, there's a difference between just going hunting and being like a hunter, being a craftsman. It'd be the difference between like someone who's a woodworker and then somebody who just kind of like fixes things, you know. Like it's definitely a deep rabbit hole to go down. And once I went into that rabbit hole, I started getting really good mentors and realizing like there's you can actually just learn what animals do and learn how they move about places and then apply that to new states. And I started doing that, and I was working a desk job right out of college, and so like hunting was my escape to, you know, actually do something physical, do something that challenged my brain, and I got just stricken with it. Yeah. So then people would hit me up and be like, "Hey, what do you think about this unit? What do you think about that place? And a lot of times these are things that places I've never been to, but I would send them pins and be like, this is how I would break it down. Do I know that there's animals there? No, but this is how they should be using the country. And people started like finding success or finding animals doing that. And then it kind of blossomed into me being like, okay, well, now I'm too busy with helping my friends to like help everybody. And so I started charging folks. And then it went from a side hustle to a full-time gig. So now I'm just kind of helping people put together hunt plans across the West, and specifically Northern Rocky states, wherever I've hunted and understand the country. I've done a couple of them in New Mexico and Arizona and even California, but like those three states I haven't hunted, but the rest of the Western states I've spent some time in, and gotcha. Usually help people there. Yeah.
Gotcha. Awesome. How many clients do you think that you go through in a given year helping prep for their hunts?
Paid clients this year, we're going to be over 50 or 60. And that's like really detailed. Like I'm sitting down with them and breaking things down. And then I always just get DMs and emails and stuff like where I'm just like helping people like one off, like, hey, start here, do this. I've got a podcast too. And, I don't know, it's in the hundreds at that point when I'm just kind of like including the little one-offs, but yeah, 50, 60 that I'm actually diving in super deep. And, obviously I'd like to increase that volume as we go, but, it's been fun. And it's super, like my favorite part is, creating a plan for somebody and having them go in, and whether they kill or not, that's not actually my metric I'm that concerned about. It's like, did you have a good hunt? Like, did you enjoy your time out there? And that's really important to me.
Yeah. Yeah. So do people come to you who have already drawn the tag, or do you help them register, like apply for the tag in the unit and things like that?
I don't help folks apply. I just don't want to end up being in the the administrative side of that is pretty janky. Like when I say janky, it's just complex, right? But what the most important thing I'm trying to do is teach people how to do this stuff. And like yesterday, I had a conversation with a client of mine who was like, okay, we have, you know, built this plan around a couple of different states. And he's like, I'm ready to do a new state. How would you go about doing this? He's like, I don't want you to do it for me. He's like, I just want you to work me through your workflow as to like finding a hunt for myself and my dad. In this case, he's going with his older dad. And that adds a twist, right? Like, I'm not going to send this guy to the same unit that I would send a 30-year-old backpacking, like, you know, mountain tough fitness athlete. So that's fun. Like, that's really fun to problem solve and teach people about those different approaches you can take.
Yeah. And that leads me to my line of questioning. All right. So I know you have your little trade secrets that you're probably going to keep, but someone says to the, you know, someone says, I got this tag. Now what? Right. Now what do I do? And they want to do it themselves. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to call you and they don't want to call someone else to do that for them, but they have a little bit of time every week where they can dive into some maps or dive into some research or things like that. And look for a spot. Maybe it's a statewide tag for mule deer, or maybe it is a specific unit for an elk. And I know that's a broad question, but what is step number one for being a non-resident coming to a new state? And that can not just be a Western state, that can be any state.
Yeah.
Where do you start?
Dude, the first question that I think people don't ask themselves this enough, but they go, the first question is, what do you want out of your hunt? You know, I think a lot of folks will just assume, like, because I do what I do, for instance, that backpack hunting is my favorite thing to do in the entire world. And it's fun. I do a couple a year, but like the vast majority of my hunting is not that. It's more like hardcore, like big day hunts and hunting places I've had the chance to scout a bunch, places I'm really familiar with after getting the tag. So I think it just goes back to, and then the other side of it, like I like hunting low country quite a bit. Right. And a lot of people coming from out west, whether it's deer or elk, like some people just look at the desert and say, that doesn't look appealing to me. And maybe in some ways I've got like desert rat genes and I like it. But, you know, like yesterday I was at, what I said, 5,000 feet, and it was cedar trees and sagebrush and rattlesnakes, you know, like that's, I like that. And I hunt a lot of elk in that kind of stuff, whether it's for myself or for clients. And so going back to the point, people just need to ask themselves, like, what kind of a hunt do they want? And you can build any sort of hunt plan around that style. If you're someone who's like, dude, I want to just have an easy, like a nice camp, and I like to drive and glass, and like you have to figure out the ways that, you know, if you're not mountain tough fit, like how are you going to create a hunt that fits your style? Like that is the first step. And I think a lot of people will just look at, you know, what's on the internet or what other people have published about something and be like, well, they say it's good, I got to go to that. I'm like, brother, if you have a 14er that you have to hike to the top to every day, and you haven't, you know, hiked a 1,000-foot climb before in your life, like that's not the unit for you. That's not the hunt you want. And even within that unit, maybe you can find some places that are crafted more towards your style, and vice versa. If you're like, dude, I'm an ultra marathoner, I do 100-mile races, like, dude, don't go to a place where there's roads everywhere. Like that's not going to fit your style either.
Yeah.
So that's step one. That's step one. And then that can help you break down what you should do after that.
All right. So you said, what do you want out of your hunt?
Yeah.
How do I know what I want from my hunt if I've never been mule deer, elk hunting, antelope hunting, whatever the case is? Like, what do you tell people as far as setting realistic expectations?
Ready to relax in your dream bath retreat without the stress of figuring out every detail yourself? At the Home Depot, your bath upgrade is covered. Shop fully designed rooms and curated bath collections to go from inspiration to transformation fast. Savings of up to 40% will make it easier on your budget. And find everything you need, from tubs to toilets and all the tile in between, to bring your vision to life. The Home Depot. Dream baths built here.
Yeah, I think if you've never been on one, then I think the whole goal is just to go see what it's all about. You know, there's a lot of people, and I just had an email from a guy about this morning. I don't know if he's ever mule deer hunted before, but he's 7 points in on Wyoming. And he's like, well, I want a big one. And I'm like, all right, like depends on his background, right? A lot of people will build points and anticipations of going on one really good hunt, but have no idea how to hunt mule deer or elk for that matter. And it's like, dude, you don't have the craft, right? Like this is kind of goes back to that whole conversation about actually knowing how to hunt more so than just getting a good tag. Because I've had the great fortune of guiding and hunting in a lot of really premium units. And you still got to know how to hunt. Otherwise, it's going to suck. Like, it's not going to be very fun. Yeah. So that's really important to me, is someone just gets out there and starts building a skill. You know, and choosing a skill, you know, a lot of people probably don't know how to, like, what skills do I need? That's where I think a lot of podcasts, you know, like this one and others, like reading in different magazines, like legit the old hardback style, picking up old books on Western hunting. Like that's where you start getting into the craft of it and learning and like figuring things out the way that is effective, not just, you know, especially for people who are limited on time. You can't do what I did and have 7 years of unsuccessful archery elk hunting. Like a lot of people don't want to go through that process. And I don't blame them. Like it sucks to not have elk meat in my freezer for the first 7 years. So I get it.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of it has to do with just the access to the trial and error, right? Like if there were mule deer and elk in Iowa, well, shit, I would be more of a mule deer and elk hunter than what I currently am. But because I'm limited and I have like 10, 11 hour drives to get to where I need to go, to hunt these animals, then I'm limited. Right.
For sure.
And so that's where like, I struck out my first 6 years going after a mule deer. I think it was my sixth year, which was last year. I finally killed a mule deer buck, and I messed up so many times Like, I messed up a lot. And I wish I could have videoed some of those hunts for the pure reason for laughter and enjoyment from guys like you, who would be like, oh my God, you did what? Right? And like, you know, like walking down a hillside and not paying attention to anything or terrain behind me, and then looking back and I'm stalking in on a buck. The buck looks up and he's not looking at me. He's looking at all the does behind me that I didn't see. And then he's just like, oh, well, I'm out of here too. And yeah. Oh my God, just not being aware of my surroundings, basically. Just humorous.
Dude, and this is the thing, I think. I was reminded this last night talking to a guy. People who've done this their whole life, who are really good at it, mess up all the time, like all the time. And it's what you do with that mistake that kind of can make or break your hunt, right? If you blow up a stock, this happened kind of early on, actually, and I ended up botching the shot. But if you blow up a stock, but can realize, like, stay calm and figure out things, like, maybe you get another one on there. That happened, like, in 2019. I stalked into this deer, got too close. He was in the thick brush, and at 19 yards, I couldn't get a shot. And then I drew back, stood up to shoot him, and I was like, oh, there's no shot here. And then he sees me, bounces across to the next drainage over, and then beds down again. And I'm like, oh, round two, let's go.
Yep.
You know, it's those kinds of things. It's like, it is worthwhile acknowledging, like, you're going to make mistakes, and that's okay. It's just what you do with those mistakes that is really important.
Yep. All right. So after you kind of figure out, maybe you're going to be a road hunter, maybe you're going to stay at a hotel, maybe you're going to do a backcountry hike in 2 mile type hunt, what's step number two?
Man, I think step number two is starting to figure out the country. Like, start poring over the maps and understanding the way that the ground lays out. You know, some places you're looking at Colorado. Some places you'll not know this until you talk to somebody or you study the maps enough, but it's just chest to 10-foot tall oak brush. And understanding that versus what looks like timber versus what looks like sagebrush and hay meadows, like, figuring out the layout of the place is really important. One of the most underutilized resources, and I know that if there's a biologist listening to this, they're going to hate me for it, but one of the most underutilized resources is just calling one of the biologists or people who are like a public servant, the warden, and just getting an overview of how this whole place lays out. Like, if you're a audio listener, you like to get that type of, like, you know, one-on-one conversation, you can always reach out to those people. And oftentimes they'll be really helpful. So, and they're locals on the ground. That kind of, you know, overview information and just getting a sense of what's happening on the ground is really helpful. The important thing too is, like, you know, this example is for someone who has a tag already. And that's important to do that if you have a tag and you haven't done this process yet. But man, I never apply for tags anymore without having a game plan in the hunt before I get there. It's like, I only want to pick up tags that fit a specific goal that I'm looking for. Like, I'm restructuring. I've got 10 points in Oregon that I, you know, thought I was going to get a great hunt or whatever. And my brother's getting ready to draw a rifle tag. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to draw a tag that takes 2 points. I'm just going to go and learn it so that then my brother can figure it out. Like, that's important to me on that hunt. So, doing that kind of research and figuring things out from people on the ground is like that next step. And the more that you can do some research on the internet, there's a lot of stuff. Like, you don't have to be the guy asking for questions on a forum or on Facebook. Just go do the research. It's already there and you can learn a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So I pull up Onyx and I find the area that I want to hunt. How the hell am I supposed to know where these animals live and how they travel through terrain when I live in Iowa? Okay. So this question is basically, what resources would you recommend to someone to learn? So I found the area or the unit that I'm going to hunt in. How do I learn from afar how these animals travel through the terrain that I'm going to be hunting, but actually haven't stepped foot in yet?
you know, there's a ton of good resources, and I would be remiss if I didn't say that. Like, I learned a ton about animals and animal movement from podcasts and articles. And I've got this, dude, I just was reading the other night. Like, I would consider myself, like, I roll into places and usually do pretty good. But I was just reading a book from 1983 the other day. It was called The Versatile Trophy Hunter by a guy who lived in Montana. And he was talking about scouting for mule deer when he was hunting them in November. And I was like, man, this is something you don't hear very much about. But this is important. And, like, you can learn something from that. So I think everyone wants to just say, like, okay, well, this resource will teach you all the things, but it's more about, you know, finding the way that you like to learn and then doing the work, man. Like, there's no shortcut to, like, doing the work and understanding what these animals do, because there's been so many resources put out there. It's all at your fingertips. You just gotta go get it. You gotta have some, you know, motivation to go find it.
Yeah. Yeah. What about YouTube? Like, YouTube, watching your favorite YouTuber. Like, can you pick anything up from that based off of what they're doing and what they're seeing?
I think you can learn a little bit about tactics for sure. Like, you think about the rise of born and raised elk hunting. And in the wake of that, and I was one of them for a long time, like, we were bugling our faces off, just trying to get one bull who wants to play. Some hunts will still, like, demand that style, right? And I'm just, like, out here blowing a bugle tube every 200, 300, 400 yards or whatever in the thick unit and doing that style. A lot of people learned how to do that from those guys. Another thing is, like, watching a really good, Robbie Denning has some really good mule deer hunting videos that he's put out, and you watch how he approaches it. He talks about looking at tracks, comparing them to his bullet casing and being like, this is a good buck track. Like, you can pick up things from that too. And you'll sit there and watch him. It's always a time lapse because glassing is so dang, like, boring, but a time lapse of a guy just gritting a hillside, you know, looking through his binos while he's got him on a tripod. And, like, those kinds of things, I definitely think you can pick up from watching these people do it. You know, the cadence of it is kind of hard to pick up from it because it's cut up so quickly. It's like a 5-day hunt will be 10 minutes long. And you're like, what? How did all that stuff happen in that short amount of time? But there's a lot of downtime. There's a lot of hiking that is just, like, boring and is a slog, but that's just kind of part of it. One of my big main elk mentors, and he's a really good friend of mine, his name's Cody Rich. He has this saying, like, we talk about, it's like, dude, if you are going to make a mistake going 1,000,000 miles an hour, and then, like, take that pivot and go do it, like, go do something again. Like, don't stop in your approach. And by that, I mean, like, if you're not sure where the elk are, like, cover miles. And does that mean that you have to do it all on foot? No, that helps a lot of times. But whether it's covering miles on your feet, trying to find sign, and, like you said, just being situationally aware, or it means driving at night, bugling, and trying to get a bull to come back, and then you park the truck, sleep there, and then go hike in the half mile or a mile to where the bugle was the next morning. Like, those are the kinds of things that I think people get out, and, you know, it's vacation time, it's a good camping trip, and they're not used to working hard. But if you want to go out and work hard, there's a way to work hard for every type of person, and that really improves your success when you get out there.
Yeah. So we've talked about, like, the resources that a guy could use. Is there some resources out there that you should be careful of using and be like, well, it might be good for certain scenarios, but I wouldn't recommend it because it doesn't match the expectations of what people are trying to accomplish?
Yeah, man, that's a great point. And, like, a lot of the old Primos videos I watched with my dad, like, is a great example. Like, these boys are hunting the Aussix Ranch in Colorado, and bulls are bugling and going crazy, and you're just like, oh my God, this looks so fun. And my dad, he loves to call, and he loves to call elk, but, you know, him and I had a really fun experience in, like, 2018 hunting elk in Colorado, in Idaho. And, you know, but in 10 days we had one experience like that. You know, it's like, you definitely have to take that with a grain of salt. And same thing with watching someone like a Brian Barney or Ryan Lampers or Brian Call, like these guys who are backpacking 10, 12 miles into the backcountry. you know, they're after a certain experience, a certain adventure, and it looks beautiful on it on YouTube. But just know that there's other ways to skin that cat, and you don't have to do that style every time. Matter of fact, like a lot of times the more effective style is, you know, just hunting hard from the day hunts. If you're like just focused on getting one. So, the Primos one was like the best example, because you're just like, it looks like an absolute zoo. But in reality, you know, it's a lot harder than what it looks like in those things.
Let's talk about like this expanding this expectation of like what to expect when you get out there, as far as like for me. I'll just kind of share a quick story. Yeah. My expectation, when I started hunting South Dakota, and I had one day where I saw, like, our first year, we got lucky, man. And we ran into a pool of bucks, and the guy I was with, we got him in close, and he smoked a giant mule deer, like 400-pound giant. He was a 4x4 deep forks, just this ideal. Like, if I was to ask AI to generate a giant mule deer buck, this is what it would have come up with. Right.
Yeah.
And so then after that, my expectation was that, oh my God, I'm going to run into this every year. And it didn't happen. And that quality of buck just was a rarity, and we just kind of got lucky. So what is your wisdom and words of advice tell you when it comes to communicating with these people about what to expect your first couple years of going out and chasing an ant, let's say for a hunter who just wants a buck?
Yeah. So I deal with this a lot when I've got people who've burned 20 points, or I guess it would be 18 points in Wyoming on the max point elk tag, right? You're like, God, do you think we can find a 370? And I'm like, brother, I've been guiding this thing for 3 years and I've only seen one, you know, like, the number one expectation that you should set is like, my football coach used to say this, like back in the day, he's like, you can only control what you do. You can only control your effort and your attitude. And I think that's the number one expectation is like, if you want a big, you know, big buck, big bull or whatever, you got to put in big buck or big bull effort and big bull time. That's the piece of the equation that I think people will come out and be like, yeah, I've got 5 days and I want to kill a bull. And I'm like, that's meat bull energy right there. Like, you know, and vice versa on deer. Got a session with a guy later this week, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to have to try really hard to keep my dad from shooting a meat buck. And I was like, you know, or, you know, if your dad's 75 years old and like can't get around very well and is glassing from the truck, like a meat buck might be just fine. You know, like, don't worry about that if he can't put in the same effort. So that's what it goes back to, is like, you know, certainly if you're starting off and you're like, just you can get lucky. You know, that I have only the very first day of archery mule deer hunting, I went out and I shot like a 26 inch wide, like nice 3x3. And I was like, dang, this is easy. It's like probably a similar experience to what you ran into. And that was in 2012, 2013. I don't remember, one of those 2 years. And it wasn't until 10 years later that I shot another buck that was as wide as that one. Like, it was, and I shot some nice deer in between, but it was definitely like, it's fine to acknowledge when you get lucky and you like stumble into something awesome. But even for people who do the same thing year in, year out, and have good hunting places, can hunt hard, like things are always changing. And that's the piece of this equation that I think people need to acknowledge, is like a hunting spot, whether it catches on fire, gets blown up on YouTube, like the management changes, like hunting spots are always evolving and you have to figure out how to evolve with them. I don't really care what the hunting spot is in my mind. It's like, it's going to change and you might get 10 years of good hunting out of a place, but eventually, like, even just the habitat, the forage, if you're hunting this place that, like, this is the deer hunting spot at my family's place, It had a bunch of cheatgrass and stuff all over it, and that was kind of fine. Like, deer were still using it. But then, like, Medusa Head and Ventanata and, like, a bunch of invasive grasses started creeping in, and, like, there's not as many deer using that spot anymore. They kind of have bumped up the hill to the neighbors, of course. So just thinking about ways that, like, things are always going to be changing. How do you adapt? Like, that's really where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah. And so how do you set your expectation then of having a realistic, like a guy comes in and goes, I want a 170 mule deer, or I want I want a 350 bull, or whatever the case is. Like, where do they find realistic information and say to yourself, okay, well, this unit doesn't have 350 bulls. This unit has more elk, but less scythe.
One of my favorite things is like when people say something like that. And if that's their, if that's what they're chasing, like the goal that they're looking for is like hitting like this size thing, then you better be good with like hitting that size or going home. Or, you know, one of the things that I do, and I know like there's guys from back east who do this a lot, like they'll come out and scout and just get it, see for themselves what's out there. Man, it's like, it is so tough. Like I drew a really good elk tag and a place that I'm guiding this year, a couple years ago. And I looked over, it was a 78 or 73 bulls over the summer. And I was thinking to myself like, yeah, I got this great elk tag. I'm going to find a giant. Dude, after 73 bulls, I didn't see anything that was any different than what I would find in a general unit. And I was like, well, now I have my expectations set for the hunting season. And like, sure, could I have worked harder and found a unicorn and then tried to hunt that unicorn? Probably. But I also, that wasn't the experience I wanted. I wanted to go just have fun. So yeah, if you have the ability to control, like finding out for yourself what the expectations is, that's great. If you're going with an outfitter or guide, they're going to know because you'll have previous knowledge. But the only other way to do it is just get your boots on the ground and see for yourself. Because like, I can think of this gal. She's about like, there's a photo of this like 240 inch mule deer, from Eastern Oregon. And, this gal is about as round as she is tall, and she's rocking Romeos, which if you don't know, they're like slip on like leather shoes. And she's got this giant buck in the back of a pickup hole. And you're like, how? You're like, so of course that unit probably, you know, it shows it has produced a 240 inch buck in the past. Are you going to spend the time to go dig one up? Cause that's a unicorn, you know? And like, I think if people, saw that one photo or like heard a couple of stories of some giants in place, but didn't actually like know where they were, then it'd be really hard to have that expectation coming in. So it's either A, go find out for yourself, or B, set that number in your brain and know that you're either going to go home empty handed or you'll find one and be happy. Like, and you should be happy either way with that hunt because you've hunted hard and like had a good experience.
Okay. I have to ask this question. And it is a private versus public question. Okay. There are some times where I'm driving through down the road and, or maybe I'm up on a glassing knob on some public and I'm looking at public ground through my spotting scope. And I'm just like, holy shit. Like there is a big, there's like, from what I'm visually seeing right now, there's a big discrepancy between public and private for quality of animals, not only from quantity, but for antler size as well. Is that discrepancy real throughout most of the public versus private in the Western states?
Man, I would say what you're finding there is just like a numbers game, right? Like you oftentimes will find animals can refuge on private ground. And so there's just more of them out there. And as a result, you get more big ones. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's like you can't keep working hard on public ground and find them. I oftentimes, when I'm scouting mule deer, because that's the best example I can think of right now. When I'm scouting mule deer, I don't really know what's in an area until I've looked at 100 bucks on public ground. If I'm sitting there staring at private and I see 100 deer or 50 deer in an evening, like in some of these places where they're just all over ag, like I don't really consider that as like a unless I'm willing to pay for access, like, or knock on doors. Like, I just don't consider that as part of my hunt plan. And you just kind of have to adjust your working expectations harder. The other thing people don't do is, like, people oftentimes won't knock on a door, and they won't ask if they have a trespass fee they can pay, and ask if it's outfitted, like, figure it out. I'm in a weird position where I grew up on a ranch, right? Like, grew up on private places, and, like, I would just, because I knew these people, would help them move cows or brand or move irrigation, whatever. Like, I could knock on the neighbor's door and be like, hey, can I go hunt up here, you know, behind your place? And a lot of times it was like a yes. But if you don't have those relationships, or don't try to build those relationships, you know, like, then that private is probably off access to you. So yeah it is one of the things. I agree. I think there's more animals there, but it doesn't mean the quality is necessarily better. There's more. And so you have to work harder to see the same amount of animals usually on public ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I, public land, like, well, here's what I'll say is, I have probably seen equal amount of deer on private versus public, but the public ground that I have seen the deer on is so much easier to get to. Mm-hmm. Like, if I had permission to get it, like, maybe it's right off the road. Maybe there's a food source on there, like an alfalfa field or something like that. And I have had success in the past being able to access through. Like, I called this guy up and I was like, hey man, I got his number. Hey, I just want to, can I just walk through this corner of your property? Because the actual crossing was down in this huge gorge where so I would have to drop down a huge face, loop down this gorge, and then come back up the other side. And so I called him and I said, hey man, can I just walk through this pasture real quick to get to get to this other piece of, and he let me. And then I've also had, success being asking if I could hunt a specific property. The guy said yes. Then the guy was crazy. And then I left. So, I mean, those types of opportunities are still there, but in really strong outfitted areas, the cat's out of the bag of how these, outfitters are running farms, and that there's additional income for some of these ranchers and stuff through hunting. So, but it's not impossible is what I'm getting at.
Yeah. And I think
that conversation,
you brought up a good point. It's like, when I said there's more, usually I'm more just talking about the animal you're hunting too. Like, I feel like that's exactly the same case with bulls or with bucks, is like, you'll see all sorts of females like on public ground, but obviously, like, people are hunting those males, like, and that's where they have the refuge. And, you'll probably see a bunch of forked horns on public and you're like, ah, dang. Yeah. And so maybe the revision to what I had said would be like, obviously you got to work to get into places where they have had refuge, you know, to find that better quality. And the difference is private is usually visible from the public or from the public road. And that makes it like, you know, the grass is greener, and it usually is. I mean, that's how the way the West was settled, right? Like, the grass is greener on private land legitimately, because they wouldn't have homesteaded it if it was, marginal places to raise livestock and farm.
Yeah. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. So we're coming down to the end here. I just want to, any other tips or advice, because we're skimming here at this point. There's so many details that go into, into getting in your truck, driving 11, 12, 19 hours to get to where a mule deer or an elk live. Is there anything else that is right off the top of your brain that we need to be prepared for, or we need to understand when going and hunting a new species out West?
And I think the first thing that people like need to think about is how they can be a student of the game. Like, everyone just kind of wants to just do the thing, and that's going to result in do the thing results, right? Like, they're going to go have a really fun camping trip, and you might get lucky, man. You certainly could get lucky and then stumble into something that you're looking for. But if you're not a student in the game, you're going to kind of run into get lucky results usually, which, yeah. you know, depending on what unit you're in and what the harvest statistics are, like it can be pretty slim. Archery elk hunt in Colorado, man, you're looking at single digit chances of getting lucky, you know, like, a rifle deer hunt in eastern Montana, though, if you're just going to go get lucky hunting the rut, like that actually is a strategy that works for a lot of people. So it just depends on what you want out of the hunt and whether you're going to put the effort in to have the subsequent results on purpose.
Yep. Makes a lot of sense. Where can we find you? Where can we find your information for Hunt West? Like, fill us in. Let's point people in that direction as a resource and let them know.
I appreciate that, man. You can follow me on Instagram if you want. I spend most of my time on like Instagram. It's either at Jaden Bales, it's my personal, or at Hunt West Planning Co. You can find a bunch of links to all the things, you know, whether it's the website or the Hunt West podcast on all those from there, you know, in the link tree. And that's probably the best place to start. If you don't have Instagram, then just go check out huntwestplanning.com and that'll get you going. And you can learn a little bit about services there. But then also, if you're not someone who wants to pay for a service, like I've got all sorts of resources, whether it's podcasts I've done, with, you know, good guests on my podcast or deep dives into a specific topic. I did one about all about like picking glassing knobs a couple weeks ago. That was on the Hunt West podcast. So I do try to go into the craft on a lot of these resources for people, whether or not you work with me. So that'd be a good place to start.
Perfect. Perfect. Jaden, my friend, thank you very much for taking time out of your day to hop on. I would love to have you on again to maybe talk a little bit about specific species and go into those details, you know, go into the details of the hunt like that and really honing the craft. Because one thing that I have learned going west is that it's a craft, just like my craft and the approach that I take with my whitetails. I need a craft or an approach for my mule deer and for my elk and for my antelope and things like that. And so I'm still trying to learn the mule deer game. I've been on the elk. I've been slapped in the face by elk quite a few times. And same with mule deer. But the more I do it, the more comfortable I get of where I need to be going, what terrain I need to be looking for, you know, water, cover, you know, where the cattle are at, the access routes, the roads, all that stuff. And the more I do it, the better I get.
That's right, man. Well, and I appreciate you having me on. You asked some great questions and it's been a fun conversation. So thank you. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network. And this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.